Welcome to the World Next Week's Summer Reading Special Episode. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Every year, Jim and I look forward to sitting down with a special guest to discuss books we've already read this year and books that we look forward to reading throughout the summer. And in this episode, we're excited in particular to talk about books we feel are important to read during this extraordinary moment, in addition to books that are lighthearted and just fun.
Joining us for this special episode is Carla Ann Robbins, an adjunct senior fellow here at the Council, where she leads a roundtable series on national security in an age of disruption. Carla is also currently the Marx Faculty Director of the Master of International Affairs Program and Clinical Professor of National Security Studies at Baruch College's Marx School of Public and International Affairs. She formerly worked as a deputy editorial page editor at the New York Times, and before that, an award-winning foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Carla, welcome back to the World Next Week.
It's great to be back, and thank you so much for having me, Bob and Jim.
Well, Jim, we spent a lot of time on our podcast talking about rule of law, so how about for this podcast? What are the ground rules for this episode?
We only have one ground rule in this, Bob, and that is we can't pick a book written by someone at the Council on Foreign Relations. So while our colleague Stephen Biddle wrote Non-State Warfare, Gail Amon wrote the terrific The Daughters of Kobani, John Campbell wrote Nigeria and the Nation State, and Ray Take wrote The Last Shah, all terrific books. We're not going to talk about them on the show today.
Got it. All right, Carla, let's kick this off. Let's start with one of your reads. What was a book that everyone should be reading right now?
So it's nearly summer, and I'm indulging myself by learning about the gold standard, monetarism, and the founding of the Bretton Woods system. Zachary Carter's biography of John Maynard Keynes, The Price of Peace, came out last May, but it's really a great read for right now when the global economy is still grappling with the effects of the pandemic and Biden is pushing for a massive infrastructure spending. And frankly, we're all anxiously wondering if the Fed will get it right on inflation. It's also about as close to a beach book as you're ever going to get for a book on economic history. So if you will indulge me, I'm going to read to you just the first few sentences because they really did grab me at hello with this book. In the spring of 1922, John Maynard Keynes was in love. He was terrified. Ever since boarding school, Maynard, as his friends called him, had been almost exclusively interested in men. Suddenly, at age 38, he was besotted with a woman nearly a decade his junior, Russian ballet starlet Lydia Lopakova. So you can see why I'm finding this book so incredibly engaging. And by the way, his friend Virginia Woolf is appalled by this love affair, but I'm a third of the way of the book already, and his love affair, if not the global economy, is still going really strong. So this is a book for our times. It has everything. It has sex. It has monetarism. It has the gold standard. And I really do think it's quite relevant to understanding why we had the system that really right now almost tanked in 2008 and is struggling right now.
So what is the gold standard, Carla?
Oh, Jim, I can't believe you. You don't want to talk about Maynard and the Bloomsbury Group. You don't want to talk about...
No, I want to talk about the gold standard. I mean, it's been a big thing in world history, and we still have people who are gold bugs who want to go back on it.
Okay, if you really want to, I mean, you can ask a political scientist and a journalist about the gold standard. I actually did understand this. In fact, it was one of the first things I explained to my husband during the summer. Other things that I found absolutely fascinating was, so this guy was trained as a mathematician because economics was considered not a particularly respected art at the time. And he aspired to be a philosopher. And he was eclipsed by Wittgenstein, who was a philosopher I did political theory in graduate school. I truly cannot decode Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein, who had studied with him and with all these other people who are part of the Bloomsbury Group in university at Cambridge, ends up fighting on the other side in World War I, ends up in a prisoner of war camp in Italy, and they make an appeal to Keynes, who is now a big player because he saved Britain from going under. They appeal to him to at least get this manuscript that Wittgenstein has out of Italy. And Maynard, who has published this, what he considers his great philosophical work, the Wittgenstein thing arrives, and he's just devastated because it is the end of his philosophical career. And basically, he just has to fall back on economics. And that's how we get Keynes.
And Keynes, of course, known for the term Keynesianism. Do we get any sense of his worldview taking shape in the midst of this romance, or it's really more of sort of the gripping events taking over his life as he was forming a view of economics, Carla?
You know, he's struggling the entire time surrounded by this group of artists, Virginia Woolf, Lytton Strachey. He's struggling the entire time to basically come up with a broader worldview about sort of the meaning of a good life and the responsibilities of people to each other as well as the state to the individual, which is one of the things that's going on there. Britain is going to implode on several times in which he comes along and basically saves them, including with this issue of the gold standard, Jim. They come to him in the first crisis, the thing that makes his career. Everybody else's economies are tottering right before the Great War. And he says, the thing that Britain has is the city. And everybody else has stopped paying out, you know, on their gold debt. You have to keep paying globally, because that's the thing that makes Britain the city, the center of finance. But the British people, you don't have to pay in gold coins anymore. The British people are going to have faith in the government itself. And it's a bet that he makes that works. And that's sort of the beginning of it. But the big thing about Keynesianism, of course, more than anything else, is this notion that if the government spends, you know, at times of slowdowns, that, you know, that it can have, you know, have a major macroeconomic effect, but also that the government has a responsibility. And if you think about FDR and what happens afterwards, and really many of the policies that continue onward, that's really the beginning, you know, that's what Keynes is pitching. So you can see why, as a philosopher, you know, why as a philosopher this is so intrinsic to him. It really is a worldview as much as an economic view.
Well, that's certainly the case over the long history of economics. If you go back to the great work by Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, it's a philosophy as much as anything else. But I'm curious, Carly, you haven't really explained to us why the title of the book is The Price of Peace. There's a bit of a story there, I would imagine.
I can answer it in the sense of, at least in the first tranche of it, using an economic term here, of course, yeah, is that one of the things that makes him and that makes his career and that makes him very wealthy is that he, you know, opposes the hugely awful ruinous reparations that are imposed on Germany after the First World War. That's one of the prices of peace, I assume. And he says that, you know, this is going to destroy Germany and it's going to destroy the economic system and it's going to lead to the rise of fascism. And he writes this pamphlet, which is a huge success, you know, with these wonderful arcane economic pamphlets. You know, I love the idea of that these turn into bestsellers. Can you imagine these becoming bestsellers in these days? And this makes him a lot of money and makes him a rock star. So I think that's the first tranche of The Price of Peace, but I'm only a third of the way into the book. I'll keep you posted on that one.
Well, I should say that book, The Price of Peace, is still assigned in undergraduate economics and political science courses across the country because it was an incredibly powerful and consequential book.
Well, and Carla, you've used the term beach reading and rock star in connection with John Maynard Keynes. So you've got my attention and I'm going to have to take a look at this book as well. You said it came out last summer?
It came out last May.
Okay.
So, Jim, I was going to recommend Jill Lepore's These Truths when we first started talking about it. And it was another one of my summer catch-ups. I must admit, for a journalist, I'm a little bit behind the news here. But until you reminded me that as ever, you were ahead of me and it was on your list last summer. So what should we be reading right now?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Jill Lepore's book, Carla, because I have been reading a lot of books about American history, and particularly recently, a lot of books about the founding. I just finished reading Pauline Mayer's great book, Ratification, The People Debate the Constitution, because even though I got a PhD in political science, never really spent much time reading about the actual process by which the Constitution was ratified. And I also got a chance to read Jack Rokoff's great book, Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. And those books are really relevant to what we're going on today. But since Bob and I have spoken about politics of the modern variant so much, I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on a sort of different topic in the news, and that's one that deals with cybersecurity. And we've been going through recently a large number of data breaches, and we've seen instances of ransomware with the Colonial Pipeline hack and then the food processor hack and the rest. So the book that I'm looking forward to reading, which I have only just bought and haven't actually had a chance to crack, is a book by a New York Times reporter, Nicole Perlroth. This is How They Tell Me the World Ends, the Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Now, this book just came out, but it has gotten just stellar reviews. Booklist, which is a group that reviews many of the books that are published, says, possibly the most important book of the year, Perlroth's precise, lucid, and compelling presentation of mind-blowing disclosures about the underground arms race is a must-read expose. One of our colleagues, Shane O'Neill, has already started reading it, and she told me it was exceptional. It was difficult to put it down because while it is a nonfiction book, it's a repertorial book. It is written in the fashion of a spy thriller, and it keeps you glued to the page. And I will note that just sort of opening the book up, the, I guess, epigram that leads the book is Buffalo Springfield. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Now, I'm a big Buffalo Springfield fan, so I'm signed up for the book right now.
Jim, cybersecurity is one of those things we don't know what we don't know. And so are we, is this book going to take us down the road a little bit more about getting a sense of just how fraught this area is? Are we going to get a better sense of what's happening or whether there is going to be any sort of ability to create, you know, rules of the road in this area?
Well, I don't know what Nicole Perlroth is going to conclude here. I would suggest that from the title, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, that it's a rather startling and perhaps pessimistic view. A lot of the book, as best I can tell, deals with so-called zero-day exploits. These are ways to break into software programs that no one's known about. Maybe even the developers don't realize that there's a hole or vulnerability, and they're extremely valuable. For many years, the United States government sort of cultivated zero-day exploits because they are very good if you want to break into the computers of other countries and the like. But, you know, as always happens, you know, if one can play the game, so can others. And one of the things that has happened is that zero-day exploits have become something that have been exploited by other foreign intelligence services, and this creates many problems. And Perlroth is, you know, in covering this beat for the New York Times, again, Carla's old haunts for many years. She's talked to a lot of people, and there's a whole dark world out there of people who deal in these exploits and other things to allow people to hack. And again, it's state operations. It's also cyber criminal groups, and sometimes the dividing line between them isn't clear. And it can even be individuals who are sufficiently good at hacking, because some of these things can be bought on the so-called dark web. And I'm hoping actually when I read the book, it'll explain to me where the dark is and tell me how to avoid actually stumbling into it.
You know, I mean, she's a really good reporter, and I actually don't know her, as you know, we can't endorse counsel things. I didn't work with her at the Times. And this, of course, is right on point as right now, because one of the lessons we're learning is that, you know, governments are not particularly competent. And the zero-day exploits is a very good example of that. I mean, a lot of the stuff that went missing, the Obama years as well as in the Trump years, some of that stuff was leaking out of the NSA that was then turned about back against us. But I think one of the lessons of the hacking that we're seeing with the Colonial Pipeline, as you mentioned, and with the meat processing, with the JBS hacking, is that so much of this stuff is in the private realm. So much of our critical infrastructure is in the private realm. And, you know, they don't have to, like, what even what we have at the council, two-factor authentication. I mean, that, you know, that we are so incredibly vulnerable, not to sophisticated hackers, but even to unsophisticated hackers. And the idea that we came that close to a Jimmy Carter-like crisis with huge gas lines for days, the idea that they could shut down 9 major meat processing plants because everybody's got terrible cyber hygiene. So yes, there's a lot of sophisticated stuff going out there, but there's a lot of also really unsophisticated stuff going out there. So, you know, Jim, you sold me. I'm going to go out and read her book also, and also make sure that my own cyber hygiene is a hell of a lot better. Although the council has been very good at pressing me on that.
You raise an important point, Carla, because I was talking about zero-day exploits, but obviously, in terms of conducting cyber hacks, a lot of it has been routinized. You don't need to have a vulnerability other than human beings. I mean, a lot of these hacks are conducted through spear phishing attempts. You sort of trick people into letting you have access to their networks. Now, I sat down recently with Rob Kanacki, who handled cybersecurity issues on the staff of the National Security Council during the Obama years. And it was very interesting the way sort of Rob laid out these problems. And you're right, a big part of the problem is much of our critical infrastructure is in the hands of the private sector. We have relatively little in the way of regulation on that front that we're going to get more going forward. It is a really big problem, in part because even when you think you have systems sort of minimizing the connection with other systems, having one part of your computer network go down may make it impossible to run another part of your computer network. And again, all of this takes on more pressing relevance now, because we're sitting here a couple of days before Joe Biden sits down with Vladimir Putin for a summit meeting in which it's expected that one of the points that President Biden is going to push with President Putin is that Russia needs to do more to rein in the cyber criminal gangs that operate in Russia and Eastern Europe. Now, of course, that gets us back to the question of to what extent these criminal enterprises, and they're not just in Russia, to what extent these criminal enterprises are really distinct from the governments in question.
Prediction is always a dangerous thing, but that might be an easy one for Putin to give Biden if he wants to give Biden something, because that's not intrinsic to Putin. That's more sort of malevolent and nuisance and a constant reminder of his ability to mess with our heads. So we'll see if that's something that he's willing to give away. There's a lot of other stuff he certainly certainly not going to give away in that meeting.
And there's also a risk to Putin in all of this, which is that these kind of ransomware attacks may have knock-on effects that the perpetrators didn't anticipate. That was clearly the case in the Colonial Pipeline hack, where it ended up leading to a closure of oil distribution, gas distribution on the East Coast of the United States. In essence, the attack had a bigger impact, I think, than the group that launched it had intended.
There's one other really interesting sort of public policy question here that, you know, cyber espionage is completely acceptable. Everybody plays the game. How you define what's a serious assault from a country and, you know, verging on an act of war, what's basic theft, and, you know, what's basic espionage, and, you know, your response calibrated to, you know, what's the nature of the crime. I mean, there are arguments that have been made that the hacking from the Chinese that we've seen that have been discovered recently, in which they basically left a backdoor open for anybody to go trampling, is far worse than what the Russians did with SolarWinds. SolarWinds, they basically, you know, they hacked a hell of a lot of things, but they closed the door after them. So this sort of distinction, you know, we use the term cyber so generally, but there's lots of different sorts of cyber, and calibrating the public policy response and certainly the response among states is something that we really have to do a lot more carefully, because I don't think this is going away.
Yeah, I would just add, as we're taping this episode, there was a NATO summit taking place, and I believe one of the topics of that was going to be expanding the realm of when you can invoke an Article 5, NATO Article 5, for defending your allies in terms of cyber attack. And so that's going to be interesting to see. I don't know what the outcome of that is, but presumably they are going to lower the bar, I should say, on what a cyber attack could be that would require NATO alliance response.
Obviously a big issue, one that could have immense consequences. But let's pivot, Bob, and let's talk about your book. What are you reading or want people to read?
I want people to read a work of fiction, actually, that I dove into late last year by a repeat author on the Summer Reads podcast, and that is the author Phil Clay. His previous work was a short story collection called Redeployment, which came out in 2014, I believe, and won the National Book Award. So his new book is Missionaries. It takes place almost entirely in Colombia. It's been described in many of the reviews and many other places as a book about the globalization of warfare and so many other things. It's a book about Colombia. It's a book about this country in this complex phase of ending a civil war and trying to sort of convert into a peacetime environment and making use of modern warfare, making use of its U.S. allies and U.S. material provided to go against the narcos, but also the legacy of a devastating war in which there were narcos, in which there were paramilitaries, in which there was military action and guerrilla action. And what I would say is this book left me as a deeper appreciation for a conflict I realized I knew very little about in terms of what the human cost was. But it's told in a very engaging way. Clay is a terrific writer. I was really looking forward to this, and it's a real page-turner. He takes four different characters and crisscrosses their stories. One is a U.S. Special Forces medic. One is a U.S. Foreign correspondent, actually, who is first based in Afghanistan and then seeks herself to be redeployed to Colombia. And then there's two Colombians, a colonel, an army colonel, and then a person who got caught up in the violence and ended up doing the bidding for some really nasty people on the ground and basically lost everything in his life. And through their prism, you get a sense of again, what Colombia was dealing with as it was coming out of the period, sort of the post-Escobar period of really out of control drug running, but still dealing with, you know, the struggle for power especially in these villages, in these rural villages. And again, a devastating impact on people involved there. It sort of deals with geopolitics at a certain level, but real morality play as well. And through these four main characters, but and everybody else they come into contact with. So I think it really meets the test of a summer read, even though it came out late last year.
What time frame is of the Colombian drug wars have been going on for like forever? And I'm going to pitch my husband's book on this topic in a minute. But what time frame is this at?
So not too recent past, the country emerging from its own civil war. The civil war is all but over. There's still some activity going on with guerrillas, and there's still some narco activity going on. But it's emerging from that, It's sort of taking place and it's following through one of its characters, the lifespan of the latter phase of the drug wars in Colombia up until, say, the mid-20-teens, I believe. And also you have with the U.S. characters, these are people who have been through the sort of nation building experiment in Afghanistan or become jaded from that and looking for something new and something winnable. And they're both attracted to Colombia. So you're seeing Colombia through the prism of a place where actually the war is being won and good things are happening. And in fact, you get up close and you realize it's a lot more complicated than that.
You know, because I had this experience in which I was working in Latin America, including some time in Colombia in the 80s when the narcos and the FARC were making their unholy marriage. And then I went off for a year for fellowship, and then Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and I went to the Middle East, someplace I'd never worked before. And I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I didn't know anything about the Middle East. Latin America was my thing. And I remember arriving in Saudi Arabia about a week after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and I got, walked in at midnight in this hotel and walked in the room, and it was the same cast of characters. We'd all sort of translated ourselves from one war all the way over to the next war. I'm not saying they were the same thing, but there was, there was an itinerant crowd of us going from war to war.
No, I think you've seized on something, Carla. I think Clay noticed that himself. So he's a former Marine who did time in the Iraq theater, among other places. And he also talks about, I think some of these elements get into his short stories as well, but he think he really got seized by the sort of international nature of warfare. And he ended up spending something like 5 or 6 years in Colombia to get that scene right and get his mind out of the Middle East and get it into that venue. But I think one of his points very much is there is this, for some parts of the world, is sort of movable parts, and there was a dynamic that was similar there.
So before, I will make a plug here. He's not a fellow. My husband and a colleague, when they were both at the Miami Herald, wrote the definitive book on the Medellin cartel long before anyone else ever wrote about it, long before Narcos. It's called Kings of Cocaine. And it's a hell of a true crime read, and you can still get it on Kindle. So I'm going to make a pitch for that.
We have to give us the author's names, Carla.
Guy Gugliotta and Jeff Lean, both of them then transported to the Washington Post. But it's a hell of a read. And I can tell you, my husband couldn't set foot back in Colombia for years afterwards. And then he kept telling me things were going to be fine. Things were going to be fine. We went to Colombia together once for reporting. And he kept saying, things are over with. It will be fine. And we check into the hotel. We turn on the TV and we see what has happened. One of his sources, who they've taken out of, former attorney general, they've taken him out of Colombia and sent him to Eastern Europe. This is still, end of the Cold War, where he will be safe behind the Iron Curtain. And what has happened? He's just been shot in the face by one of the Narcos people who's been dispatched to. And I looked at my husband and I said, things will be fine. Hell of a
crap. Any other stories about covering Latin America you want to share with us, Carla?
No, but I want to talk about the gold standard, Jim.
Okay.
It did make me think in reading this book also, I recall in my surface knowledge of Colombia and its peace process, the painstaking effort towards the public approving the peace process. And I think one of the big sticking points was they were not happy with the deal that the guerrillas got to kind of reacclimate it to society. They wanted them to be stronger, a critical mass of the population. And I think part of that comes through in terms of the way you see reprisals being depicted in this book. And Clay's he's clearly not taking sides. It's sort of just, you're seeing it, the power of the writing is such, and the way he constructs this is such that you're feeling like you're having a lens into this world. But it did make me think of that period, it was a really tough moment for Colombia. And it's because of moments that are depicted again and again in the book where there's just the brutality is just grotesque.
All of these have been great recommendations. We're going to put the topic of the gold standard aside right now, and we're going to talk about some books that are on the lighthearted side of the library aisle. Carla, we're going to start with you. Anything you want to recommend?
Continuing the Latin America theme, I'm going to start reading Leonardo Padura's Mario Conde detective novel series, inspired in part because he does have a new one in his series. I think it's number 9, which is The Transparency of Time. But since I haven't read any of them yet, I'm picking it up. I worked as a reporter in Cuba, and both as well as did my husband, and we love the Four Seasons in Havana series that was on Netflix. And if you haven't seen it, it's off now, but I recommend trying to track it down. And the thing we really loved about it, and the thing I'm looking forward to in these novels, is the way it made Cuba seem almost like a normal country. Conde's a classic, noir detective, and he's also a frustrated novelist who solves crimes of party corruption, not ideological purity. But it's still Cuba, at least as in the Netflix series. There's the grimy police cafeteria with a Che mural on the wall. Conde's out there getting drunk at night with his best friend, who's a disabled Angola veteran living with his mother in a crumbling Miramar mansion with Creedence blasting in the background. And so I'm really looking forward to doing this because noir in Cuba is so incredibly appealing to me. My husband, I was discussing it with him this morning. He's certainly getting a lot of play in this podcast. Is a huge fan of Padura's more literary novels, particularly The Man Who Loves Dogs, which tells the story of Trotsky's exile, the Russian-trained assassin who killed him in Mexico in 1940, and another frustrated Cuban writer, this one in the mid-1970s, who becomes disillusioned with the revolution after meeting the likely assassin and learning about Stalin's horrors. The puzzle about all of this this that's so fascinating, and it was fascinating watching the Netflix series, which actually was filmed in Cuba, is how Padura gets away with this. You know, he continues to write what is really seditious work and still lives in Cuba. He's probably the most famous living novelist right now in Cuba, and he's constantly, constantly poking at the revolution. So that's going to be my summer reading.
I have to ask you, Carla, because you have covered so much of Latin America. What is your take currently on where Cuba is headed? The Castros have exited stage left, no pun intended, or maybe so. But where do you think Cuba itself is headed?
You know, we used to have these debates, you know, is Cuba going to, you know, were the Castro regime or the Castro era going to end with a bang or a whimper? And it just never occurred to me that it was never going to end. You know, I was there after the wall came down, and I remember having conversations with people who'd been real believers in the revolution, who basically said that, you know, that the party had gone on too long. I mean, the revolution had done good things. You know, it really had educated people, had given, you know, dealt with health issues, had kicked the gringos out. You know, there are things, you know, Michael Corleone was gone. I truly love that scene in the second Godfather when they're on the top of the Capri Hotel and they're cutting up that cake of Cuba. So there were some good things. But God, when you think about it, I mean, it's like, what, 89 to now? It's 32 years later. And it's still, it's not as isolated as North Korea, but it's pretty damn isolated and self-isolated. So this is not what I expected. It's just really, really limping along. Obama, you know, that opening was, you know, I think a really good idea because it takes away the excuse for what are the failings of an intrinsically, I think, incompetent and corrupt system and a repressive system. Not repressive the way Stalinism was repressive, certainly not the, you know, repressive the way the Uyghurs are treated in China, but it's a pretty repressive system. I mean, the way they let off steam, of course, is they tend to kick people out than throw them, you know, thousands and thousands in jail. But it's a, you know, it's not a great place, and it's limping along. It really is limping along. Biden, interestingly enough, having been there with the Obama opening to Cuba, which Obama did more than anything else because of pressure from both left governments in Latin America and right governments in Latin America. It was a consensus of this has just gone on too long. Biden doesn't show a particular interest in opening up anymore. I mean, he's lifted some of the things that Trump did, some of the rollback, but not all of it. So I don't have an answer, Jim, because if you'd asked me in 1989, I would have said it wouldn't have lasted another 5 years. So clearly, my predictive powers are limited.
You know, Carla, you mentioned the detective author being able to sort of get away with it in terms of poking at taboos and so forth. But it also makes me think, to what extent is Cuba in any way susceptible to outside, you know, sources of information or media or other influences that are clearly showing there's a better world out there? And you know, Cubans, if they only had a voice, could, you know, and could chuck out this corrupt regime and bring in something a little bit better. Is there any sense that the regime is a bit too resilient or has proven too resilient to be in any way, you know, buffeted by sort of the outside world?
Well, it's certainly open to the outside world. I mean, Miami is really close, and there are parts of the island and times of the day in which you can get Miami drive time radio on your car radio, on your very old car radio, or your Lada, if it has a radio when you're driving around. That was always the joke about Radio Marti, which is, you know, the XL radios, is that you really didn't need it because you could listen to, you know, Cuban XL radio in Miami. And relatives, you know, come in very, very welcome because, you know, the Cuban government's very good at sucking dollars out of relatives who come. You know, that's where you have all the foreign exchange. If you rent a car, it's in dollars. You know, you want to buy things for your relatives, an air conditioner, it's all in dollars. They're very, very good at doing that. So it's not that people don't know what the outside world is like. They do have very limited access to the internet. That's been improving. That was one of the things that Obama was really pushing. And that was one of the expectations of the opening. I don't think it's moved anywhere near as fast as everyone had hoped. Why do they retain power? Certainly the government controls the gun. And it's really what people have known. They've known, and, you know, there's a particular thing about being an island, I think. And I think we are complicit. You know, we gave them the excuse for a very long time. So, Bob, you already told us about one great novel, although I don't think it was light reading. Do you have something fun and light for us?
I'm going to give you a twofer, actually. I'm going to cheat a little bit, Carl, and give you a twofer. One is another piece of fiction, which I do think is lighter, although also very resonant in today's world. And the other one is going to be more of an essay that I think is also sort of required reading of another sort. First, I'll start out with the fiction, which is, I'm going to go back to 2002, and a book I haven't read yet, but I'm very much looking forward to, called Year of Wonders, a novel, The Plague. Plague, the first novel of Geraldine Brooks. Now, Brooks since then has gone on to great fame and great notability as an author of fiction. She won the Pulitzer Prize for a book several years after this one, which was a fictional take on a character from Little Women.
March, right?
March, exactly. This book is, she decides to seize on a story she came across about a remote English village back in the mid 17th century or so that gets hit by the bubonic plague. Believe in a bolt of cloth. This is a
true story.
I'm sorry,
is this the light reading that you were going to give us?
This is my light reading.
Yes.
Because it's Geraldine Brooks and because she has a certain quality of her writing and an uplifting quality as well. The title is Year of Wonders. Okay. It is a novel of the plague, but the wonders are involved in not only in how something like this, the people in the story are wrestling with how could God's judgment be so severe on them, and others saying, you know, arguing that it's not so much God as it's just, it's science. It's the fact of what happens when something of this nature is allowed to spread. Suffice it to say, there was a true story that was the kernel of her story, which was a remote English village decided to self-quarantine to stop the plague in its tracks. And she takes it from there and basically goes off and sort of imagines what went on in this village, the minister who kind of led the effort, but also she has as a protagonist a woman who's a widow, a young widow who's a housemaid, who ends up becoming sort of the hero of the story as well. And so I'm interested in reading into it, just because of the many parallels, I think, that seem so obvious now. This book came up a lot in discussion in the past year after the pandemic spread, and I had been wanting to read it. I'm a big fan of Geraldine Brooks in any event, and I should note her career started out as a foreign correspondent with the Wall Street Journal.
Yay.
And she's also, her late husband was Tony Horowitz, another favorite author of mine. Her first book overall was Nine Parts of Desire, which was a well-regarded book based on her experiences among Muslim women in the Middle East. So, a great accomplished author, but her first novel out of the gate, choosing a subject that seizes on sort of all the issues that we're wrestling with as this pandemic continues to play out. I just thought it was a choice, and admittedly, it's not the lightest reading I could have chosen. I will throw in one more thing that also is not necessarily frothy fare, but I think it's really important, and I do it just because it was a book that caught my attention, almost seized my attention on my bookshelf that I hadn't looked at in a really long time. It's actually an essay from a companion of pieces by Václav Havel called Living in Truth. And the essay is called The Power of the Powerless. There was just section after section in it as I started flipping through it that I found incredibly relevant to today's world. I want to read one really quick and just let people think of it what they will. He talks about the control of information, basically. And Havel's talking about the ossified regime in Czechoslovakia in the late 1970s when he's writing this, which is 1978. And he talks about the corrosiveness of the ideology. He calls it, quote, almost a secularized religion. It offers a ready answer to any question whatsoever. It can scarcely be accepted only in part, and accepting it has profound implications for human life. In an era when metaphysical and existential certainties are in a state of crisis, when people are being uprooted and alienated and are losing their sense of what this world means, this ideology inevitably has a certain hypnotic charm. To wandering humankind, it offers an immediately available home. All one has to do is accept it, and suddenly everything becomes clear once more. Life takes on new meaning, and all mysteries, unanswered questions, anxiety, and loneliness vanish. Of course, one pays dearly for this low-rent home. The price is abdication of one's own reason, conscience, and responsibility. You know, you can think about lots of things when listening to that. It's resonant for me in terms of what's happening still in the neighborhood of Eastern Europe and Belarus and Russia, but also with the populist way that we've seen hit many democracies in the world. And I think that this compendium, Living in Truth, there's a lot of information that makes you very thoughtful and reflective at this time period. So that's my extra bonus that I'm throwing into my reading list.
Well, it makes me sad. I'm sorry. It's not fraud. And it makes me sad because when you think about all the hope that we had for Central Europe and Eastern Europe with the end of, you know, and Václav Havel in particular, who was such an incredible symbol. But it wasn't just him. I mean, you know, it's look at a guy like Orban in Hungary. I mean, he was supposed to be a great, you know, there was a time when he was campaigning, you know, anti-communist. I mean, and all of these people who were pressing for open societies and freedom and all of this. And there's been so much backward sliding and rise of populism and authoritarianism. That's, you know, these countries that are meeting right now in the NATO summit, some of whom you really want to ask yourselves, what the hell are they doing inside NATO and the EU? And so one wonders in reading in this essay, whether there's some explanation of in that as well. You know, how did they go so wrong?
I would just add as a final point is where the essay comes out, which is that people have in their own power the ability to kind of throw off this ideology and this sort of magical thinking that he accuses these regimes of fomenting. And it's really the seeds of what became the Charter 77 movement and very effective dissident movement in Central and Eastern Europe. But as you say, it makes you also feel a bit of sadness because it lasted for almost a generation in some places and now it's being sort of turned on itself. But it's still, I think, holds up very well.
Can I ask the both of you, are we possibly being too pessimistic about our current circumstances? And I'll note, Carla, when you were telling the story of Cuba and what things looked like in the early 1990s, your sense was that because the trend was very positive then, that great things were going to happen, that was a disappointment. Is there a potential here that we are engaging in the same kind of thinking, but in reverse? That is, there are real possibilities for optimism, but because the trend recently has been going in the wrong direction, we're convinced that's the way it's going to continue to go.
I mean, I will say that it fills my heart with great joy to have an American president out there this week talking about democracy, talking about alliances, and getting it, not just mouthing the words, but getting how important it is to pull alliances together and to press the fight in really important ways. I mean, some of the things that Biden says, you know, they sound either overheated or, you know, frankly naive when he talks about, you know, inflection points. This is a verbal tic he has. He talks about inflection points all the time, but damn, it's nice to have an American president who gets how fraught the times are and how fragile they are. So yes, Jim, I think we have to worry about it, particularly because we also have a rise of authoritarianism at home, but I also feel optimism and because I think good people are worried about it. So yes, I will be hopeful if you ask me to be.
And I'll ride on Carla's hopefulness as well for the same reasons. I think it was that we came through last year with a really tough election period for wherever side you were on in the United States. It was a very stressful period. January 6th became another inflection point, to use the term. And the response to that has been even more troubling. And so I think, if you might have guessed, I was channeling a little of that, of the sort of the big lie myopia in Havel's comments, because I think it's really important. It's playing out in a way I never would have imagined. And that alarms me. But at the same time, I do think there's a lot to be optimistic about, too.
Good. I'm glad we got at least a little bit of optimism out of this conversation.
All right, Jim, it's on your shoulders to bring the summer reading episode full course and deal us up a book that we can all look forward to and lifting our spirits.
Well, Bob, I'd love to offer you one book, but since you have already broken the rules by offering two books, I'm going to do likewise. And because I want to be equally handed on this, I'm going to offer Carla, if she wants, to throw in her second recommendation on this front, if she is so inclined. But if she doesn't want to, she doesn't have to. The two books I want to talk about are very different. One is a book. It's a collection of 11 short stories. The title of the book is Objects of Desire, and the author's name is Claire Sestanovich. Now, for people who listen to The President's Inbox or to The World Next Week, at least regular listeners, that name may sound familiar, yes. Claire is the daughter of Steve Sestanovich, who is senior fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to go back to our original ground rules, which are that we couldn't talk about books by Council Fellows. We didn't say we couldn't talk about books by offspring of Council Fellows. This is a debut book. It is due out later this month. A couple of the short stories have already appeared in print in places like the New Yorker, Harper's, Paris Review. I'm still waiting for my pre-ordered copy to arrive, but I have read Claire's short stories, just two of them, in the New Yorker. And having read them, I can understand why the book reviewer for Entertainment Weekly wrote, "A debut story collection of the rarest kind. You wish that every single entry could be an entire novel." And as I read these two stories that Claire Sestanovich wrote, what strikes me is just what a beautiful writer she is. And her writing tends to be very spare, but every word is telling. And I have to say, it's with more than a bit of envy I feel as I read through these short stories, just given just how beautifully they're told and how moving and emotional they can be. And I just heard one line that really really jumped out at me said, I only like thinking about the future because it hasn't happened, which I just found to be sort of very insightful. So I'm very much looking forward to reading the other short stories in the collection. My second book is entirely different, though it's related in a way. And that's a book by John McWhirter. It is Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. Now, I said the books are linked in a way. I mentioned how beautiful Claire Sestanovich's writing is. And, you know, all three of us on this podcast do a lot of writing. And part of the tools of writing are words. So I've always been very interested in words. I like books about the art of writing and how to write better. You know, books like Lynn Truss's Eat, Shoots, and Leaves and Bill Bryson's The Mother Tongue, Steven Pinker's A Sense of Style, and of course, the classic Strunk and White, Elements of Style. So I like books in this general line. And it's a book about the origins of our profanity and how it's changed over time. Now, I can't tell you much more about the book because I'm not allowed to use any of the nine nasty words in a Council on Foreign Relations podcast. But having read about a third of the book, it's incredibly well written. It's kind of funny. And words have long origins. And it's interesting how people's sense of what is profane has changed over time. It has not been consistent over the course of the history of English. And I doubt very much it's been consistent over the course of any other language. The other thing I just want to point out is that linguists are really interesting people who tend to write very interesting books because, in one sense, the practice of linguistics can be very mathematical, very complicated, but also words provide and phrases provide all sorts of grist for really good storytelling. And McWhirter is a very good storyteller.
Does he have an explanation for why certain words, words which we are not allowed to say on this podcast, seem to be repeated in English, even in other languages? I mean, this insight, which I have taken since I've not been able to go anywhere, and we have not been able to go anywhere for more than a year, all of my traveling has been done on Netflix and Amazon Prime. But, you know, every Scandinavian noir crime show I've watched, every French crime show I've watched, there's a theme here of all the television watching I've been doing, is that there's a hell of a lot of cursing on these shows, and most of the cursing is done in English, even though they're speaking a foreign language. Is there an explanation for that?
There may be, Carla, but I'm only about a third of the way into the book.
Standard explanation.
Yes. What I have been focused on right now is learning about two words that I think I can say on the podcast. One is damn, and the other is hell. Now, these are not the nine words or nine nasty words that McWhirter talks about. You can sort of think of them as sort of the two words he begins the book so you can get ready for the real profanity. But that's also part of the story because there once was a time in which to utter those words in polite conversation would be to have committed a major social breach, which is why you get this talk of sort of the substitution for these words. So things like darn and darn it, or H-E double hockey sticks. So you wouldn't say the word hell or say Hades rather than that word. And so it's interesting. And again, over time, words that are spoken of or can't be spoken become more and more acceptable and other words take on this quality of being profane. The other thing that's really interesting about the profanity is that there are some words that, and we're not going to mention them on this podcast, but you can read McWhirter's book to learn what they are, that are considered profane in American English, but are bandied out pretty casually. Let's say if you are in Australia, and I can remember one time my first visit to Australia when I heard someone over lunch use a word in particular, which I would never be caught dead using publicly or privately. And they were just tossing it off because in Australia, it doesn't have the same connotation and same impact. So even within a language, depending on where you are, what is the word that crosses the line can be quite different.
Jim, I will note that we're almost at 50 years since the famous George Carlin skit, Seven Words You Can't Say on TV, came out. And those words, I think most of them, for the most part, are still pretty much taboo. Except I will note that one of the phenomena of the expansion of the podcast realm is that you encounter a lot of podcasts in which people are pretty much saying anything that pops into their mind. Some of them will say ahead of time, well, we're allowed to just swear on this podcast, but others just sort of have at it. It's kind of curious. you know, since podcasts are so widely distributed now, but still sort of relatively less regulated, to recall the brouhaha over the Carlin skit. And today it's just sort of, oh, you know, there's a couple buckets I know I'll go and there'll be F-bombs all over the place before the 5 minutes are up.
Yes. Well, it is hard to avoid the use of F-bomb if you are watching any streaming service or going to the movies. That's true. But I'm glad you raised the issue of George Carlin's routine, because McWhorter addresses it on page 2 of his book. And he writes as follows. And you're probably waiting for me to get to George Carlin's famous routine about the 7 words you can never say on television. It would be downright antisocial not to list them now. I'm going to be antisocial and not list them. The question is, though, why that routine is so well remembered almost 50 years later. While some of us would be hard-pressed to remember anything else Carlin said, or anything that comedian David Brenner, also a phenom at the time, ever said at all. And if you draw a blank on Brenner completely, case in point. And that's really sort of where the book begins.
Well, I will accept the David Brenner, but I will reject the George Carlin. I remember a lot of George Carlin. But it is true that journalists have potty mouths, and we have incredible potty mouth household around here. So it's, I think different professions have them as well.
I should note on that score, Carla, that journalists are not the only people, certainly not the only profession, that loves to indulge in profanity. And I will note politicians have often indulged in profanity. American presidents have often indulged in profanity. And sometimes they have been caught on tape using profanity. Current President Joe Biden, when he was vice president, used an off-color term, if I can put it that way, when he was talking with President Obama about a major piece of legislation, abbreviated as BFD. So, you know, lots of people across lots of professions, social classes, use profanity. But Carla, I said I was going to give you a chance to recommend any other book, so you get equal treatment. Is there a book that you would like to recommend?
Well, since Bob has invited us to look at our bookshelves, and I will say that every 5 years I indulge myself, and I think the time has come again, is that I reread the George Smiley series. And because I don't think anyone who cares about national security could possibly ever find anything better than those. They are just an absolute delight. And I love spycraft, and I love those, and I love the fallibility of human beings. I love the fact that Smiley is sort of sad and brilliant all at once. And I would also recommend that you watch the BBC version of this with Alec Guinness. The movie? Not so much. But truly, I'm always jealous when I meet people who say they haven't read the Smiley books because they get to read them for the first time. But I think 5 years is probably enough to get back in and make believe it's all new again. So that'll probably be my other summer reading.
An absolutely wonderful recommendation, Carla. And I love the way you phrased meeting people who haven't had a chance to read the Smiley books because they'll get to read them for the first time. I can remember reading them back in the 1970s for the first time and how much fun that was and how much schoolwork I missed because I was more engrossed in what John Le Carré had to write than what my teachers offered me to read.
And I would just add the same for those who haven't seen the Guinness version, because Guinness is Smiley. And even if you've read all of them, you know, every 5 years like Carla, just to see it brought to life like that, it is a real treat. And it sends a chill up my spine just thinking about it. Now I have to go rent them and introduce my kids to them. And that wraps our summer reading special episode. To all of our regular listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special episode and that you'll tune in 2 weeks for our regular look at the world next week. Carla, thanks so much again for stopping by to share your must reads with us.
It was really great fun. Thanks for inviting me.
Carla, let me just add my thanks to Bob. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Great to see you.
And if you weren't able to jot down all of the authors and books we talked about in today's show, don't worry. I'm going to provide a summary of the books we recommended on my blog, The Water's Edge, which you can find at cfr.org. Tweet us your favorite international relations reads at cfr_org using the hashtag TWNW. And please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. As always, thank you, Zoe. Enjoy your time off. Special thanks to Michael Kohler for his assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.